The News Dissector with Danny Schechter, Fridays at 1 p.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network.
Thanks. I'm coming on in a second with News Dissector Radio. Stay with us.
Whatever comes up, they win. Politicians are paid off to keep the game running. There's just no way you're going to be competitive in a rigged game. Some of the best people we have will never get a shot.
This is a movement moment. That's Polarity One's new song, Occupy Wall Street, Occupy This. And it's a hard-charging series of beats and actualities and other music to really energize people in the way that, in a way, Occupy Wall Street has energized the country. You know, you've just had the President of the United States speaking, you know, in Congress, the State of the Union address, and feeling somehow that he had to reposition himself as a populist, as someone talking about economic inequality, as someone talking about fairness and economic justice. Is all that real? We'll be discussing that in a minute, but nevertheless, it's a sign that the conversation has been transformed because people are out doing things. You know, there's an old saying, it's not the ship that makes the waves, it's the motion on the ocean. And when there's motion, when people are acting, when people are angry and people are communicating their message, guess what? The society reacts, the media reacts. And, you know, there's no question that the debate taking place in Florida between Romney and Gingrich, in which, you know, questions of Romney's great wealth and his tax policies, where he's actually overpaid on his taxes, if you can believe it, after saying, of course, he follows the law, you know, turns out that even his, you know, specialists, his tax guys, couldn't figure out how to present his taxes. So, you know, there's a kind of a scene going on there in Florida and the GOP, primary with all of its so-called, quote, debates where these candidates regale each other, where we learn very little except who gets the punchiest soundbite in. Yet, the unseen presence in all of this has been the Occupy movement, which has essentially defined the issues that these candidates have to address and discuss. And we'll talk a little bit more about this. You can join me on this program by calling 888-874-4888. That's 888-874-4888. It's a free call. You can take part in this conversation. I'm going to basically comment on the economy, but with some musical selections that you might find of interest. Joining me, Catherine Waters. Catherine has been an activist in Occupy. She's been tracking all the different activities. She's a stalwart. She marched from Zuccotti Park to Riverside Church, 1,700 miles here in Manhattan. Not really, but, you know, felt like it on a very cold night. Basically, basically on Occupy the Dream, supporting the principles of Dr. Martin Luther King. Last night she joined me at Jesse Jackson's Wall Street Summit. Not exactly the same style as Occupy Wall Street in the Sheraton Hotel, but a lot of people were there discussing and debating economic issues, how to get into the economy. I was there the other night, and Jesse basically said, how many of you in this audience have someone in your family in jail? Hands went up. How many of you in this audience don't have a job? Hands went up. One out of two black men in New York City don't have jobs. Then he said, how many of you are trying to find jobs? Many, many hands went up. How many are you trying to get contracts, you know, as minority contractors? Many hands went up. Again, you know, people who are frustrated, exasperated by being pushed out of the economy, excluded, you know, from participation, either on racial grounds, ethnic grounds, or because they just don't know how to get connected, how to be part of it. And that's one of the things that the Wall Street, you know, Summit is actually discussing down at the Sheraton. Also last night, Catherine and I were sitting in that very serious center of conversation, the hotel bar, and to our left, we were listening to a conversation that was, you know, intense between Jesse Jackson's wife and Malcolm X's daughter in this bar, talking about, you know, the legacy of you know, her husband and her father, and how to actually respect it and how not to get uptight if people attack it, to keep stressing the positive nature of the work that they've done. One of the things that Jesse Jackson did do yesterday, and this is now on the AP wire and getting tension nationwide, is he sent a letter to the Grammy Awards protesting against the dropping of certain categories for excellence in music. Among the categories being dropped are R&B, you know, original R&B, Hawaiian music, Latin jazz, you know, all the ethnic categories that bring soul and spirit and allow you to meet new artists and hear other sounds that you wouldn't ordinarily hear. They're being dropped in a, quote, reorganization by the Grammys, which is really part of trying to create a show with more stars and bigger audiences and not really showcase the ethnic diversity of the music in this country. And when one of the people from an organization that's at GrammyWatch.org went there and talked to Jesse about it and explained it to him, he was like shocked, and he said, what can I do to help? And he jumped into action. And that's the difference between him and a lot of other people who listen, you know, oh yes, I'll think about this with my advisors, blah, 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 and guess what? Do nothing. But he's acted. Cornel West has sent a statement telling the Grammys he does not approve of what they've done. So this is becoming a political issue. And the Grammys are taking place, I think, the 10th or 12th of February, the Staples Center in L.A. Some artists are going to be picketing it. This is some way in which, you know, the same thing that's happening to our other institutions, our politics, our economy, our universities, polarization, division, people debating and arguing with each other is now beginning to happen in the music world, too, because certain musical forms are basically dominating and pushing out other musical forms of expression. Catherine?
Well, at least they had the Occupy Hip Hop in the same hotel where we went last night and just kind of caught the tail end of it. So, I mean, you know, at least they're trying to keep that alive.
Yeah, there's a lot of young people there who are trying to use hip-hop, you know, to promote social ideas. They did promote and got me to buy a T-shirt, which I was happy to do. You know, this is part of an effort to try to reach out to all people in this country who are feeling like we need some real change here, and we're not getting it. Joining us in the studio, Sue Min, who's been basically assisting me on at Global Vision on some of our projects. She's leaving. I'm not sure why, but she's going to Idaho because it's not cold enough in New York, I guess. She wants to be in a place that's really cold, and joining her is her brother. What's your brother's name?
His name is Young Woo.
Yang U is here from South Korea. Welcome to the studio. Welcome to our program. You know, so we have a lot of people dropping in. The only people who aren't dropping in this week are our guests. Okay. although in the second half hour, we will be talking with Katie Ornstein from the Op-Ed Project, a fascinating effort to try to increase the diversity of voices in the national conversation and national debate by, in a sense, empowering people to write op-eds, to be part of the whole debate and discussion. One of the things she told me was that, yeah, women and minorities do get to write in the newspapers, but what do they write about? They write about women and minorities. In other words, they're not considered as people who have a voice on other issues, just like their own special interests. And that's a mistake, and that's wrong, because there's so much talent in this country and so many people who have things to say, and they shouldn't be confined to what they can talk about legitimately, you know. I mean, Catherine, at one time you were a big disco queen in Brooklyn. I mean, if people said, well, the only thing you can talk about is disco, you know, that would have limited, you know, your contribution. And this is what Katie is going to tell us about in a little bit. But we're going to start off with some music from the album that we did on my film, In Debt We Trust. That came out in 2006. It was a film basically talking about the debt crisis that most Americans experience: mortgage debt, credit card debt, student debt, and the like. I put together an album with Polarity One of different types of songs about all of this. And so we're going to listen to one of them now. This is Alfred Reed. Alfred Reed was a blues singer, and he wrote this during the Depression. And he said, how can we stand such times as these? How does a poor man survive?
A time when everything was cheap, but now prices almost put some men to sleep. When we pay our grocery bill, we just feel like making our will. Tell me, how can a poor man stand such times and live? I remember when dry goods were cheap as dirt, we could take two bits and buy a dandy shirt. Or more, maybe get a shirt that another man wore. Tell me, how can a poor man stand such time and live? Well, I used to trade with a man by the name of Bray. Fly was 50 cents for a 24-pound bay. Now it's a dollar and a half beside, just like skinning a flea for the hide. Tell me, how can a poor man stand such times and live?
Hey, how can a poor man stand such times and live? Good question. It's a question we haven't answered yet. It's a question that a whole new generation is asking now as poverty in America increases and intensifies. And in fact, Bruce Springsteen heard this song and has re-recorded it because he feels it's important. Bruce, just last week, endorsed Occupy Wall Street. He was the one who gave so many concerts for Obama, supported Obama, if you recall. And, you know, now he's aligning himself with Occupy Wall Street, as have many people who supported Obama. And now you have a situation where Obama is trying to get those people back, and he's making all kinds of announcements, including an announcement for an investigation of Wall Street crime, an issue that we've raised and discussed on this program many times, that I treat in my film Plunder, The Crime of Our Time, and my book The Crime of Our Time, which is about financial crime as a cause of the whole economic crisis and financial crisis that has really not been reported, except in occasional cases of one or two big shots who are on trial for insider trading or something like that. It's not really explained to the American people how pervasive this financial crime has been and how critical it's been to undermining our whole economy, the whole market system. And that's why, in my opinion, this issue is important. The question is, will what Obama is proposing, a new financial crimes task force, led in part by Eric Schneiderman, the Attorney General of New York State, will it actually crack down on financial crime? And that's a big question, because the Attorney General of the United States and one of the other top operatives of his, both of them work for law firms that service big banks. So a lot of people are saying, isn't that weird? You know, how do we expect them to crack down on big banks when they work for big banks? And now there's a report basically that Wall Street is the biggest source of money for the Obama re-election. They have what they call bundlers who go out and try to raise large sums of money, millions of dollars. And Obama has been very successful at doing that. So will his donors, the people who are giving him money, allow him really to go after them? It's a big contradiction. It's a big question. I don't think so. I have an article coming out on this on Al Jazeera probably this weekend, talking about the State of the Union address and about this whole notion of populism, which is something that Obama is now positioning himself as. I mean, it's good that at least these issues are being discussed. I'm happy about that, although the whole State of the Union address was something like, there's something in it for everyone. You know, I killed bin Laden, I'm Mr. Big, I support our military, I support, all of these ritual, symbolic political stances. And, so he threw in, for the left, essentially, this whole issue of, Wall Street crime. And then he appointed Schneiderman, who he was supposed to introduce at the State of the Union. Schneiderman was sitting there behind his wife, behind Mrs. Obama, and he was never introduced. And this reminded me of what happened with Elizabeth Warren. Remember, she was crusading for a consumer protection agency. It ended up as a consumer protection bureau inside the Federal Reserve Bank, not as an independent agency. And then, he didn't appoint her to lead it. After making her, an economic quote advisor, she got so frustrated she's now running for Senate in Massachusetts. Catherine?
I just wanted to quickly, my brother in Columbus, Ohio, working for Nationwide Insurance, he sent me this article. President Barack Obama talked a lot about renewable energy during his State of the Union speech Tuesday night, but he made it crystal clear he plans to renew his administration's war against coal while forcing expensive, unrealistic alternatives.
Well, so the whole energy debate is very intense. He canceled the Keystone Pipeline, which many conservatives want. This is a set of issues that are beyond our ability to explain here exactly at this moment. But it's all part of the debate between the public interest and the private interest, between what the market is demanding, supposedly, and what the people need. And that's a conflict that doesn't only take place here. It takes place in South Korea. It takes place all over the world. And so, which brings me to a new song. Ethan Miller wrote a song called The Market Song. We'd like to share that with you.
I'm gonna buy you lock, stock, and barrel. I'm gonna buy you out, and there is little doubt that I'm gonna make a lot of money, then I'm gonna get the hell out. Well, the first rule of the market is don't panic, and the second rule is you should panic first. 'Cause if everybody panics at the same time, then the whole damn stock exchange is gonna burst. This is the game of the market, where everybody's maximizing profit. Money changes hands by the dictates of demand. Oh, it's stupid, yes, but nobody can stop it. Well, the price of stocks is rising, it's a record. We can dance and drink.
So there you go, Ethan Miller, The Market Song. It's on my album, or Polarity One's album, or the soundtrack of In That We Trust. We try to do music to popularize some of these issues, and to try to bring these issues to the people. But the other day we were down at Occupy Wall Street, and there was a crew from Time Warner digging, putting in new cable down by Zuccotti Park, which had been the headquarters of Occupy Wall Street. And Catherine goes up to this guy and
I just jokingly I asked him, are you guys installing cable for the Occupy people in the park? You know, and of course, you know, his automatic answer was, what, for those crazy people? And, you know, at least, you know, I wasn't alone. At least, you know, Dan and I were like a tag team trying to inform this guy of the reality, you know, because he had like the same opinion that most people have, you know, oh, those people just need to get a job.
I'm Danny Schechter, known as the News Dissector. I'm a filmmaker and sometimes a troublemaker, and I want to dissect my new film for you called In Debt We Trust. It started out to be a documentary about what I thought were other people's problems. I came to realize, though, how deeply they affected me as well. The experience of making this film has led me to understand how many ways policies and practices tied to our growing national debt burden have had an impact on my own personal finances. Even as a former network journalist and longtime investigative reporter, I was shocked, even outraged, when I started probing the roots of these issues. This is a problem involving millions of people and billions of dollars, yet it's widely ignored, rarely discussed, in all of its disastrous dimensions. It's about a growing inequality that some experts fear will lead to a new 21st century serfdom. It's about the transfer of wealth from working people into the vaults and accounts of a relatively small number of financial institutions and real estate interests. The lenders are not only profiting by charging high rates and late fees and the like, but doing so legally in part because they've mastered the art and science of marketing their products to us and then manipulating our politicians and political institutions so they can get away with it. Most often, credit card abuses are examined in terms of individuals and consumer scams like identity theft. My film started with that approach but evolved into a much deeper look at what's been called financialization, an institutional problem involving a growing debt and credit complex that threatens the very fabric of our nation, not just in terms of a possible financial crash in the future, but how it's impinging on our lives and our livelihoods right now. Over the course of my career, I've made maybe 20 films and won many awards and some recognition. Most have been shown at top festivals and aired on TV. I'm attached to all of them. But In Debt We Trust is different in that it just doesn't document suffering. It warns of the implications, the consequences of this process that will affect all of us. Perhaps that's why this issue cuts across party lines and partisan lines in a way that can potentially unite us. Perhaps that's why everyone I tell about the film tells me about how they become personally ensnared in the debt trap, in the turnstile that they check into but never check out of. My hope is that this film will encourage a national response, a demand for economic fairness and justice, regulation in the public interest, along with a heightened sense of personal responsibility by consumers like you and me who are seduced by the false promise of free money. What's been called the democratization of credit has led us to become a country with a negative savings rate and to the democratization of dependency. It's created an unsustainable society, trapping millions in a financial hole they can't escape from and often do not even understand. Over the past 25 years or so, America has moved from a country based on production to a society driven by consumption, from a land that once shared its resources with the world to one deeply in debt to foreign banks and other countries to the tune of trillions of dollars. As the growing number of bankruptcies and foreclosures testify, government debt is mirrored with the skyrocketing consumer debt, with a growing number of individuals and families just unable to cope. I spoke with the former governor of Georgia, Roy Barnes. He told me, it's shocking to me how intelligent people, educated people, have not taken time to think about this. We cannot sustain over an extended period of time these high levels of debt, he says. And he says that this is a threat to the way we are as a people, and nobody seems to be concerned about it. Well, I'm concerned about it. In Debt We Trust is concerned about it. But we're also concerned about what we can do before the bubble bursts. First, we hope to put this issue on the national agenda. That's what the film hopes to do. Working with the country's leading credit card expert and critic, Dr. Robert Manning of the Rochester Institute of Technology, we hope to use the film as part of an educational campaign to help individuals improve their own financial planning and then encourage organizations to get involved in a national campaign for justice.
To chase and to Wachovia, Wells Fargo, Sally Mae, to MasterCard and Citibank, and also B of A. American Express and Visa.
I'm Danny Schechter. I'm your News Dissector back on the News Dissector Radio Hour here on Progressive Radio Network. The number to call, 888-874-4888, 888-874-4888, if you want to join in. Katie Arnstein is with us. She works and helped create something called the Op-Ed Project. And we want to know more about that because this is part of an effort to really broaden the diversity of our media system, to get other voices into the media, and not just on in a self-interested way. You know, if you're a woman, you only can write about women's issues, but people who have something to say and have not until now really had the place to say it, because the media system has tended towards, you know, kind of white males or people of certain conservative leanings, and have excluded lots of other voices in the various national conversations and debates that we're experiencing. And, you know, I know this well because I worked at ABC News. I worked at CNN. I worked at CNBC. I saw who the guests were that they went for. I myself was a talk show producer at CNN, and I know that they wanted the same guests that the other networks had. They weren't really interested in other voices and critical voices and voices that encourage you to question what you're reading and what you're hearing or listening to another perspective. So the other day I was down at the Fenton Communications new offices, palatial, not really, at the Film Center in Manhattan, and I ran into Katie and I began, you know, hearing about how her project has emerged. And I begged her to come on the show and talk to us a little bit. Apparently one of her colleagues is going to be joining us as well. Katie, welcome.
Thanks. It's great to be here. Hi, Danny.
And Ann is here, too. We'll hear from her in a second. But first, Katie, introduce our audience to the Op-Ed Project and to yourself, because for some reason last night, as busy as you were, you didn't send me your bio, so I don't have it in front of me. So tell us a little bit about you and about this project.
Yeah, I'm a journalist and an author. I've written books. I've covered everything from, you know, Haiti to pop culture, media, women's politics. And essentially, I've trained as a folklorist and became a journalist because I landed in Haiti 20 years ago. I had a grant from my college to go study folklore, and a coup broke out while I was there. And so, you know, I've got a very fast introduction to the world of journalism. And I think something that's really interesting to me is people often, over the years, would say to me, what a weird transition, folklore and journalism. Aren't those things mutually exclusive, you know, fact and fiction? And I thought so too for a long time, and yet over the years I began to realize that, in fact, they are not so exclusive at all. And in fact, if you look at history, what goes down in history, the salient factors are seldom what's true and what's false. It's almost always who tells the story. And that's the much more interesting element for me, and it's something that I've been studying and working on and practicing myself in various ways over the years. Who tells the story? Who narrates the world? What is the version of history that we understand, and why?
Well, guess what? While you were talking, I'm looking at the top of the New York Times today, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Romney stays on the offense with Gingrich, his voice attacking Gingrich. Second article, Gingrich stuck to caustic path and ethics battle, a critique of how he misrepresented all sorts of issues and used language as a tool to attack his opponents, to demonize them, to discredit them. And so, again, the narrative, who's telling the story and who isn't. Israelis assess threats by Iran as partly bluff. A whole article about what the Israelis say, but what about the Iranians? They're not in there way at the bottom. They may react to it. There might be a balancing paragraph, but again, it's Israel's side of the thing. And then there's a whole article, as tensions rise, Egypt bars exit of six Americans. One is son of official. Washington threatens to withhold annual aid to the military in billions of dollars because they're questioning certain Americans who have been involved in Egypt. And the guy that they're questioning is the head of the Republican Institute, which, you know, both political parties have international institutes. The Republican International Institute, Katie, was very involved in the overthrow of President Aristide in Haiti. So these are, you know, groups that are not just making studies and analysis, but actually actively intervening in politics. And so I don't know the rights and wrongs of what Egypt is doing, but the assumption is, how dare they question an American? Therefore, we're going to cut off all of your aid. And, you know, so this is just a representation, in a way, of what you're saying about who tells the story.
Yes, indeed. I think really you're looking at two things here going on that are important. The first is that there's a very narrow range of voices that we hear from, and that a certain type of voices, a certain section of society, has a disproportionate access to the world's microphones. So that's one thing. And if you happen to fall in that subset, you're going to have more opportunities, just statistically, to have your perspective shared. And the second is, what are your skills and abilities to shape the narrative? If you look at, for example, what you mentioned about Romney and Gingrich, you're talking about, well, people who are using their skills, using whatever awareness they have of the components of influence to shape the conversation. And that's also another element. So you have both a macro look at what are the kinds of things and the types of people who disproportionately can be heard. And second, what are the skills and abilities of these people as individuals? And it's not only individuals, because as demographics, we share within among people who look and talk like us and have access to similar places and similar backgrounds as us. We share information. So it's not just our individual abilities and skills, but skill sets that we share among our let's call them our kith and kin group. And so those are two things, but I think it's really important to bring into the conversation that things are shifting dramatically. There's an opportunity for a shift that's very dramatic right now. We're at an unprecedented moment really in history where anyone with access to the internet can have a public voice right now. Anyone with something to say and access to the internet, which is, you know, completely unprecedented for many, many centuries. The people who had access to printing presses, or who were anointed as our quote-unquote thought leaders, was a very, very tiny subset of the population. And right now, almost anyone can have access. It doesn't mean that they'll say anything good, and it doesn't mean that they'll necessarily be heard, but it is an opportunity. It's an opportunity to change potentially the sort of demographics of thought leadership right now.
Well, we know, you know, that when institutions change, opportunities open up for other people. I mean, there was a lot of battling, you know, women's movements and groups had to try to get into the media, to try to be seen, to try to be heard, and to give voice to concerns that women had, but also concerns that women have about other things in our culture. And what we're seeing also now is this whole Occupy movement, which has all kinds of voices that are questioning the actual narrative about, you know, about the economy. Is it all about debt and deficits, which is how the Republicans wanted to frame it? Or is it about economic inequality? Is it about 1% dominating the 99%? In other words, how you frame the issue, how you discuss the issue, often is how people will participate or not in that. One of your colleagues, Anne, I believe, believe, is on the phone. Could you introduce her, Ann?
I'd like to. Yes, Ann is our director of operations, but she's also an alum of our program, and she's come through. We work in various cities around the U.S., various major cities, and Ann has actually been to most of them. So not only has she come through our program and is running a great deal of our programs, but she's also seen a lot of other people come through. And even today, she was looking through one of the fantastic pieces that just came out today. So, Ann, I don't know. I'd love to hear what your thoughts are on this. What have been I'd love to hear you weigh in on the kinds of voices that maybe, I don't know, that you've appreciated out of this program.
Well, Katie, the first thing that I would like to say is when I first took the op-ed seminar last July in San Francisco, I was part of a very diverse group of women, about 16 women, that ranged in age from a high school student to someone who was newly retired. And within that cohort, there were certain things that were shared. The first thing was women who felt like they had something to share, they had an expertise to contribute to the discourse that was going on within the public sphere. And you know, at the same time, there was also a real desire to work through some of what they saw as things that had been barriers to entry for a long time. So you know, in effect, it's more than just a writing seminar. It really is, you know, working through some of the cultural constraints and you know, why the question of you know, why and how people participate in media, and really how to elevate you know, this diverse group of voices. Mm-hmm. And from that experience, which was absolutely transformational for me, you know, I really began to wonder, you know, what can I do to even contribute to the growth of the organization, to make sure that you know, I'm helping in expanding this group of participants in the public sector, in the public media. And in beyond that, you know, how do we share in the successes and build on the groundswell that's happening right now?
Can I just jump in here for one
sure.
second? Because, you know, I think it's important. I read a bunch of headlines from the New York Times today, you know, about who dominates the narrative. But, you know, all these people who are dominating the narrative all have media advisors. They all have political consultants. They all have people who are specialists in advertising. You know, Roger Ailes, who now runs Fox News.
Yeah, they do indeed.
He used to be an advisor. So a lot of people who are left out of the discourse right now, they could get into the discourse because they don't feel either empowered enough or skilled enough about, you know, how to do it. And they don't have those resources, that support base of people advising them what to say, how to say it, how to look, what to do. And so that's what our politics is today. It's very manipulated and packaged. You know, it's showbiz as much as it is newsbiz.
Yeah. Danny, let me jump in and say something a little bit about the evolution of why we exist. You know, 5 years ago, and this touches on what Anne is saying as well, 5 years ago there was a big debate that broke out about why there are so few voices we hear from in the world and why so few women in particular. Larry Summers gave a speech at Harvard and he wondered why so few women in higher math and science. Could it be biology? And then there was a very, very public fight in the media industry sparked by Susan Estrich and Michael Kinsley, then editor of the LA Times, about why so few women on the op-ed pages, and Estrich accused the LA Times of sexism. And then a big national debate, sexism, socialization, biology, what's the reason? And that was actually the origin conversation for the op-ed project, because as a journalist who had actually written for a number of these op-ed pages, I knew there was something else that no one was talking about, and it was submission ratios. And you know, almost anyone who works in any of these forums on the inside can tell you that the ratio of women submitting to men submitting is quite low. And the Washington Post did a tracking over 5 months, in fact, as a result of this sort of Donnybrook. They found that over that five-month period, 90% of submissions to that enormously influential page came from men. And in fact, if they looked at bylines, it was 88% of their bylines during that same period came from men. And that is almost a 1-to-1 ratio.
88%, wow.
And yes, but it reflected submissions. And it occurred to me that, you know, we as women are actually being fairly represented in the Washington Post, at least in relationship to our submission ratio. And
yeah,
it occurred to me, you know, all of that fight about sexism and biology and exclusion, by the way, as well. You know, all of those things could be true. They surely are true on some level, but how will we know if we're not actually submitting? I mean, if you are not playing the game, how can you win the game? And how can you rightfully complain? And so we decided the origins of this project, why don't we increase the number of women submitting? So now, by the way, this is not a women project. We're actually, what we are is a diversity of voice project. If you look at the global brain, if we could call it the global brain, it's like a computer running on 0.01% RAM. We are getting the same kinds of voices, and the same voices, literally the same people, over and over again. And it's not that they're bad voices. They're actually very talented, interesting voices often. But they're the same, and we are in an echo chamber. And it's not a smart way to live as a globe. It's not a smart brain.
Well, what could we do to increase the smartness of that brain? Katie, if I could just stop in here for half a second. I mean, one of the characteristics of the Washington, D.C. inside the Beltway environment is all of these various think tanks. And all of these think tanks have media, you know, people there pushing out speeches, reports, studies, op-eds by their principals, because partly they attract funding at the end of the year. Yeah. They go and say, look, we've been on the Washington Post op-ed page 93 days in the last 93 days, you know. This is one of the problems here. People who study the op-ed page of the Washington Post during the beginnings of the war in Iraq discovered that it was almost 10-to-1 or 20-to-1 pro-war, and no voices that were dissenting or critical, really.
So Danny, let me jump in there, because I think there's a decision to be made when for people like you and me and other people who are interested in the media and thought leadership and the ideas we hear in the world. And the decision is, do you want to be an observer or a critic or a commentator on it or an analyzer, or do you want to jump in and do something about it? And I think many of us have decided both, but there is a bit of, which direction do you lean? And we at the Op-Ed Project lean in, though, we want to step in and do something about it. So we spend a lot of time, we have a statistician on board, studying who gets heard and why and what they're saying, essentially who narrates the world. But at the same time, we're also a little bit saying, you know, like biology, socialism, sexism, who cares about all that? Let's just get in the game ourselves. So yes, you're calling out a problem. There is a finely tuned, finely oiled system for certain kinds of opinions to get into the media. And we can focus on that or draw attention to that or analyze that. Or we can say, hey, what about the rest of us? What can we do to get the rest of us in there? And that's effectively what we at the Op-Ed Project have chosen to make our area of interest. So we run programs all around the United States that are designed to get people who have ideas and experience and knowledge of public value, whether they come from a think tank or whether they are coming from a prison reentry program, which, by the way, is an excellent source of data for potential reform of prisons.
So they,
whether they come from, you know, high or low, left or right, how could we increase their abilities, the quality and the range of voices we hear from, and their individual abilities?
Catherine,
those are the programs we run.
Did you have a question?
I just wanted to make a comment, along the lines of what she just said. It's like, right, like the people who are being squeezed out, they need the ones, you know, who are doing all the talking to actually make room to let them in. I mean, if it's the same people that are always being heard, like obviously they're being heard because that's their personality or whatever, like they, you know, obviously have it within them to do it on their own.
No, Catherine, my whole point is they don't do it on their own. They have all these forces behind them, pushing them, helping them, you know, training them about how to intervene in the media. They're not, and that's why, you know, this op-ed project, I believe, is training people, also. I mean, one of the things we found, Katie.
Somebody has to, like, help those not being heard.
Well, that's my point.
That's exactly what we do.
Right.
So I want to just say, like, if I could, Danny, that there's two things here. The first is that is exactly what we do, to answer the question here. We run programs, and we don't just run programs. We run programs to train people How, you know, what are the components of influence? What is credibility? What is expertise? How do you establish credibility? Where do good ideas come from? How can we cross-pollinate? What's the difference between being right and being effective? And how, what factors will determine which one you'll be? And what's the bigger picture? And how can you tie into it? We run those kind of programs. So they're not media training programs. They are true and fundamentally thought leadership programs based on sort of interactive, high-stakes games that help people articulate what they know and why it matters. And then we run a national mentoring program where we match participants with high-level people in the media. If any of your listeners are interested, you can go to our website and see our upcoming programs in 8 cities around the U.S., and we also run programs through universities and nonprofits. But I want to get
what
back
is that
to
website?
Really
You and I are both like motor mouths, you know. We talk quickly. Just give people the information on how they can contact you.
www.theopedproject.org. No hyphens, just theopedproject.org. And you can find us online, and you can see our upcoming programs, which are open to the public, and which we run approximately 40% of participants pay in words rather than dollars, which is our version of scholarship. They submit a draft op-ed instead of paying. But Danny, I want to get back to one thing that Anne said, which is that Anne was describing her experience that the program was as much about ideas as confronting these sort of psychological barriers that everyone seemed to have in the room. And that's something that, you know, we've been in existence 4 years now. And one of the things that was extremely surprising to me was that we created this program that was meant to be sort of training, like straight and simple, like let's get more people on the op-ed pages. Those pages feed and drive all other media and thought leadership across all other industries. Let's get more women. Let's get more diversity. Let's just train them. But what happened is the people coming through our programs, they immediately had resistance to the very notion of themselves as having a right to have a voice. And so we began to be aware that there was a psychology that, right. So it's not just the media sort of establishment keeping us out,
right.
But rather that almost all of us as minority voices, and women, by the way, are a minority voice, even if we're the majority of the population, and almost all of us as minority voices experience what I call a psychology of self-abnegation,
yeah.
Whereby we don't appreciate or fully realize what our contribution could be, or what our expertise may be, or even our social obligation to participate in the world conversation. And we repeatedly hear common or possibly universal conversations, which Anne was referring to. Do I have a right to have a voice? Do I know what I'm talking about? Am I an expert in anything at all? We have people with Pulitzer Prizes or Academy Awards or Nobel Prizes or 20 years experience as astrophysicists studying galactic black holes say that they aren't prepared to talk about the issue that they've been training their lives to talk about.
Jesus.
So I want to say what's very interesting about this is that social science research supports what's happening here, but there hasn't been an enormous connection between that research and what's going on in public media, in the sphere of public thought leadership. So social science research suggests that minority voices begin to doubt their own basic competencies. And there are scholars at universities that have done experiments. And it, by the way, you might just be in a minority opinion. It doesn't have to do with necessarily with your race or your gender or your class. It could be a minority opinion. And if you are in the minority, what happens is that you will begin to doubt in different ways, but you won't necessarily attribute it to being in the minority. Your own basic competency.
Well, you know, this is why these issues, in my mind, are very important. They go beneath the statistics. You know, you showed me some statistics about how what a fight it's been in a way to broaden and diversify the media. But there does seem to be some progress taking place, and largely because people have the skills to submit, to advocate, to be more aggressive and more outspoken about issues that they really care about. I mean, we've seen, you know, somebody like Rachel Maddow come out of radio, no TV experience really, and has become a major TV host. There are a lot of examples.
Yes.
Of this sort of
yes.
thing. But, you know, I wanted to call attention to the work that you've done, because I'm very impressed with it. I think that our listeners would be impressed with it. We're going to have a podcast of this program probably tonight or tomorrow that I'll send you if you want to use it. Please do, because I think you articulate these voices, these values very, very well. And I also want to just say that that's really what our whole program here on Progressive Radio Network, PRN, FM is all about, trying to broaden the debate, the conversation, reach out to other voices, try to have more discussion. And if you want to reach me, you can do so by writing to dissector@mediachannel.org. I have a website, a blog that I do called newsdissector.com, and on that I will post the actual podcast information, and so will PRN-FM have it in their archive so you can find out about it. I think what we're seeing here is an interest, a hunger, for other voices, other choices, other opportunities, other ways of thinking and doing. And that's what, we're here to try to encourage. And having you on, Katie, has been a joy, and thank you so much. I know we only, we only touched the subject. I'd love to have you back and to get into some of the substance more.
Yeah.
Because, I think when people hear what you're saying, they're going to want to be more involved. And that's part of promoting. Catherine cannot be stopped. Yes.
It sounds like an issue of self-esteem. It's just encouraging people to have self-esteem. And
yes and no. I want to just, we get that a lot. And I would like to just perhaps offer something about our own language. Because oftentimes people will say to us, because we work overwhelmingly with women right now. Obviously, the idea is much larger, but our starting point is women. And people will often say, do they lack self-confidence? Do they lack self-esteem? And I think that's one way to think about it. But I actually think that way to think about it comes, in the context of, sort of a sexist culture that we live in. And there's another way to think about it, which is this. People tend to do things and think about doing things and believe they can do things because they see other people who look like them and have a similar background to them or might even know them doing those things.
I'd like to say amen to that right now. We're running out of time. That's why I'm intervening here. I'm not being rude. I'm just trying to enforce the clock. Catherine sits in the studio, but she never watches the clock, so she doesn't realize the program is about to end. Thank you for listening to News Dissector Radio here on PRN. We're going to go out just to pay tribute to two artists who've left us in the last recent period, the great Johnny Otis, a Greek American in San Francisco, decided that he wanted to be identify with Black America, and most people thought he was Black, but he was an R&B artist, and Etta James, the great singer. And to go out, we want to play a little song from South Africa, which is the song that people sing to people who are moving on into the next world.
Tamuyingwe
Oyingwe 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 Oyingwe
Shinua, 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 Shin
Oh, yeah.